This podcast is brought to you by Minimal Productions, producer Jim Mintz.
Bail is refused.
You're out of order!
If it pleases the court.
To adopt this affirmation, please say the words, I do.
I do.
Nothing further from this court.
Given the serious nature of this offence,
this case is dismissed.
Welcome back to The Wigs. I'm your host, Jim Minns. In March of this year, The Wigs recorded a live show at the Reasonable Cause Continuing Professional Development Conference. Yeah, that's right, folks. You can listen to The Wigs to fulfill your ethical obligations to continue your professional development in the law. The topic was ethics for defense lawyers, and the panel discussion you are about to hear examined the basis of ethical obligations, the nature of the fiduciary obligations lawyers have, common ethical breaches, some of the reasons why they occur, and how lawyers should respond to complaints. Reasonable Cause CPD New South Wales represents a different approach to the delivery of continuing professional development. When you spend your money on a Reasonable Cause CPD conference, you will know you are making a difference. Reasonable Cause CPD gives 100% of its net profit to Reasonable Cause Incorporated, which is a charity that focuses on assisting disadvantaged young Cambodians to advance their education. Reasonable Cause CPD New South Wales has raised hundreds of thousands of dollars thus far in support of disadvantaged Cambodian children. Friend of the Wigs, Mark Dennis SC, runs the Reasonable Cause CPD, and the Wigs are always happy to assist a very reasonable cause by donating their time. More info on Reasonable Cause can be found at rccpd.net.au.
Thank you everyone for being here and participating in this. This is actually a recording of our podcast, which is called The Wigs, in case you're not familiar with it. As Mark has already done, but for the purposes of the listeners at home, I'm going to reintroduce The Wigs, if you don't mind. I've got Stephen Lawrence, Felicity Graham, Manuel Kirkasharian. If you could clap so it'll help our audio, that would be very appreciative. Just so it doesn't look like I have to put in one of those canned laughters in post. Today we're going to discuss, well, the last time we participated in the Reasonable Cause CPD, we were previously discussing the role of prosecutors and issues, I mean, I hadn't listened to it in a while, but issues surrounding the actions of prosecutors outside the matters at hand. And today we're going to turn the focus on defence solicitors. The Wigs are going to talk about complaints. We're going to talk about common ethical failings that can pop up in practice, and also just some tips that can be used when dealing with complaints that are made against you, and a whole host of case studies that will hopefully you'll find enlightening, what to do, what not to do. I'll take it to you. I'll leave it to you guys to interpret what these guys do, because that's what I try to do with every episode. And without further ado, I'll take it up to the experts.
Okay, thanks, Jim, or Ringo, as we sometimes call you.
Some of you do.
It's good to be here, everyone, and can I thank Mark for having us here. It's our second time to present here, and I'm sure I speak on behalf of all of us in saying that we're really happy to support Reasonable Cause. Obviously, CPD is important, but it's incredible, I think, to think about all the money that's gone to orphanages to help kids, and just really good to be part of helping that cause by coming along today. So we thought we'd kick off, and look, it's not going to be like a law lecture or something like that. We're going to try to keep it pretty chatty and pretty anecdotal, because you know, we think that it's important to have an exchange about the common types of ethical breaches, but also some of the reasons why ethical breaches occur. So we thought firstly we would try to talk about what are some of the common breaches, and we've gone through a variety of sources to prepare for this, including Law Society annual reports, which are a rich source of some of the bad things that lawyers do.
Legal Services Commissioner.
Legal Services Commissioner, yeah. Just by way of sort of introduction, I guess, the description of these obligations as ethics, I think, can sort of turn our minds to thinking about these obligations as things that are based on morals or values and basically doing the right thing, which is an important consideration. Or morals and values, I think, can be an important source of ethical obligations, but I think as practitioners, it's really important to think about our ethical obligations also as rules of law, because they ultimately are, because they sit in the form of codes effectively, though they're not exclusive in the sense that not all our ethical obligations are written down, but they do sit in the form of rules that are promulgated under legislation. And in our discussion earlier, we were talking about how if you think about your legal ethical obligations as just some form of doing the right thing, that will probably get you a fairly long way to doing the right thing, but there are various ethical rules that are not that intuitive, and you could be very much trying to do the right thing and trying to act in a moral and fair way, but if you're unaware of the exact technical prescription or proscription in the ethical rules, you could actually do the right, you can actually do the wrong thing in quite a serious way and be subjected to consequences for that, even though you're basically trying to do the right thing. And a couple of examples, I think, come to mind on that topic. One might be the use of documents that you've obtained under court processes. And I've certainly known of examples of solicitors in the early years of practice who've got documents in their file or in their practice that have been obtained, for example, under subpoena, and they just don't know about the rule that you can't use those documents other than the purpose for which you obtained them under the court process, and have used them in court proceedings and done the wrong thing in quite a significant way, even though it never crossed their mind that that was the wrong thing to do. I think another common example that arises is acting for more than one client, which is obviously something that you can do. And as a young solicitor, for example, you might have seen that happening and think that you can do it and you can do it. But unless you think, I think, quite deeply about in what circumstances you can't do it, then you might find yourself on the wrong side of an ethical complaint, even though you're basically trying to do the right thing. So think about your ethical obligations, I would say, as things that rest on morals and values, those things that underpin ethics, but also think about it as a strict source of law and be on top of the solicitor's rules and other forms of regulation, because at the end of the day, it is legal regulation.
Can I just tease out there, Stephen? Yep. There's sort of, it's interesting with the two examples you gave. There's a distinction between sort of the rules around the harm and undertaking and so on, the rules about when you can and can't share documents, which are a lot more bright line. And then the second example of where a conflict, whether or not you've got a conflict with the client, which is a bit more factual and a little bit more feely, although when it comes down to it, it's your practising certificate that's on the line.
Yeah.
And so you've really got to deal with both of those things. But I think the point that you're saying, Stephen, is that actually there are these kind of weird rules like the harm and undertaking or whatever it's called these days that you've got to actually be across and know about, that nobody really tells you about unless you're done. Look a little bit deeper.
I think the takeaway is common sense, intuition, that gut feeling that something might be unethical will take you a long way, but that is no substitute for being really familiar with the rules and applying the particular rule to your particular circumstances and working out whether you're doing the right thing or not. And sometimes it will turn out that your gut feeling that you shouldn't be doing something, when you apply the rule, actually you're permitted to do it. One of the examples might be the rule around delinquent clients, or, you know, the client that tells you, I did X, Y, and Z, and how you can still act for them in a defended way. So, really important to be across not just the fundamentals of what seems ethical, moral, the right thing, acting in the best interest of your client, helping the court, but actually really getting across the details of the rules and being really familiar with them.
Can I ask, sorry, what are the, I mean, I am the layman in the room here, I apologise for listeners at home. So, like, you've got the UCPR rules for the civil procedures. What's the criminal rules? What are we referring to here?
So we're talking about the rules of ethical practice.
Okay.
Yeah, and we're using, so there's the solicitor's rules, there's the bar rules, and then there's I think also model rules that
have not been adopted yet. It's all UL now. So it's all uniform law.
Yeah.
So what's the act called?
This is where our prep would have come in handy.
No, I prepped it. I'm just trying to find the citation for it because we jumped around.
It's unethical not to prep.
It's the legal
profession uniform law.
Yes. Anyway, whatever it is, it's the uniform law.
It's Jim Minns just cutting in here. The Whigs are referring to a number of pieces of legislation, but primarily the legal profession uniform law of 2014, which contains provisions for the regulation of legal practitioners, including complaints, and the legal profession uniform conduct barristers rules 2015, and the legal profession uniform law Australian solicitors conduct rules 2015, which contain a number of express ethical rules of broad and specific application.
And under that, there are legal profession uniform law New South Wales 2014, which is part of the scheme that I think applies now across all of Australia, which may even include Western Australia, I don't know. But under that, there's the solicitor's rules and there's the barrister's rules that are regulations. All of it has the force of law now. And whereas before it was just the Bar Association or the Law Society would issue their rules, and the courts would say, well, that's the rules, but it's not really the rules. Well, now it has the force of law. And, you know, when you go to the definitions of unsatisfactory professional conduct, as we might in presently, or professional misconduct, they're giving the force of law to real kind of loose propositions. Like, professional misconduct includes things where the conduct of a lawyer otherwise in the connection of practice and law that would justify finding that you're not fit and proper.
Yeah.
So that now has the absolute force of law because of the legislative scheme.
Yeah, and I think what this discussion highlights as well is I think we would often in our practice think about incompetence or falling short of the required professional service standard and being unethical as different things. Like, you might think of some lawyer that they're a bit of a shonk, and you might think of some other lawyer that they're not a very good lawyer, but the two things are really connected. And if you fall below the required standard of service in a negligent way or something more serious than that, then it might be unethical too, in terms of the ethical rules.
It's literally the definition of unsatisfactory professional conduct. Is conduct in the connection of the practice of law that falls short of the standard of competence and diligence, so you're not, you know, you're lazy, that a member of the public is entitled to expect of a reasonably competent lawyer.
Yeah, though it should be said, and I remember appearing in a matter where there was a particular outcome in a trial, and I think it was a retrial of a matter that had already run, and we ran a completely different defence, and the person was found not guilty. A whole lot of evidence was excluded that shouldn't have been in evidence in the first trial. And the client ended up making a complaint because they were annoyed that they had to endure the second trial. And I became sort of privy to what occurred in that matter. And there's an approach taken which is mindful of the fact that there's a range of decisions that you can make in a matter. And the body receiving a complaint of incompetence or falling short of the required standard is going to take that range of decision-making freedom that you have into account. So not everything is second-guessed according to some very high standard. I suppose what I'm saying is you can provide pretty not that great standard of legal services and not necessarily be in breach of unsatisfactory conduct and so forth.
Yeah, but
that's the reality of it, I think.
Can I say this as well? When we're talking about complaints, we're not limiting that to a formal complaint to the Law Society or to the Office of the Legal Services Commissioner or to the Bar Association. These types of issues might come up where the client is just dissatisfied or their family member's dissatisfied and they complain to you or they complain to your employer about you. And so when we're talking about not doing a good enough job or you know, falling below that expected standard or the other ethical breaches that might arise in defence practice, we're taking a broad view of that in terms of how a complaint might come about.
And also, you don't want to be complained about, right? Yeah. So the standard's not, to my mind anyway, the standard is not what's the standard in the Act. It's how am I going to
meet that standard and not be complained about.
Yeah.
Because the complaint, you know, and then you're notifying your insurer and you're spending a lot more money and so on. So
yeah, and a common thread that flows through some of these case studies that we'll talk about is you as the practitioner normally receive the complaint, and depending how you deal with it might determine whether it ends up with the Law Society or the Legal Services Commissioner, which, you know, is not to say that you should accede to every complaint and refund money in every situation, but the chances of copying a substantive complaint to the body are going to be higher if you don't, I think, pragmatically speaking.
Yeah, Steve Mark, who was the former Legal Services Commissioner, wrote a really good paper about ethics. And one of the things he said is, if faced with an unhappy client, managing any potential complaints at the earliest possible opportunity is really important. Lately, I've noticed an increasing trend in which legal practitioners have not responded to a complaint by their client in circumstances which could have clearly prevented the client from approaching my office. I'm both disappointed and bewildered by practitioners who fail to manage client complaints at the earliest possible opportunity. In my view, a failure to acknowledge and deal with such a complaint is both discourteous and unprofessional. Legal practitioners, as a result of their position in society, are obliged, as servants of the public, to act in a manner that reflects that privileged standing. And the duties that arise from this privileged position extend to managing client expectations and responding to their complaints. So, you know, if you handle a complaint well in the direct interactions with a client, you can avoid it getting any more serious in terms of an actual complaint to one of these bodies.
Yeah, and I think another closely related point to that is, in terms of your chances of copping a complaint, there's a close relationship between that and how you treat people generally. So, for example, you've got a client who gets imprisoned in proceedings. If you go and see them in the cells afterwards and listen to them and talk to them and explain it, I would say there is a much less chance of you copping a complaint in that circumstance, because you've treated the person with respect, you've taken the time to go down. If you, in advance of the proceedings, explain things properly to them, there's much less a chance of copping a complaint. If you're rude to them, if you're discourteous, if you're rude to their family, there's a much higher chance of copping a complaint. And it's the same for doctors in professional negligence cases. There's a strong relationship between how they treat people and the prospect of being sued by people. So it's a good thing to bear in mind, because complaints are stressful and difficult.
And that also, I think, applies to everyone that you're dealing with, the prosecutor, your opponents, witnesses, whoever. There's no reason to not be absolutely courteous, professional, accommodating in your approach in terms of your interactions with all of the other people in the system.
Yeah.
Get your cost estimate right.
Yeah, we'll come absolutely to that. We're going to come to a case study about that.
So in terms of common breaches, so one, according to these Legal Services Commissioner reports, is a delay in or ineffective communication. So simply not communicating with the client. So an example that comes out of the annual reports is especially clients in custody. So
The example you just gave, you mean?
Yeah. So clients languishing in custody, might be a hearing date set, have no contact with the solicitor for months and months and months. That is not ethical. You've got an obligation to send letters. You've got an obligation to speak to them at key junctures and explain what's happening. And again, it relates to what I just said about treating people properly. It's a client in custody, it's stressful and difficult, and they don't hear from their lawyer for months and months. Overcharging is a huge one that comes out of these annual reports. Now, we have an unregulated fee environment, essentially. There's a requirement to be, I think, fair and reasonable. But the days of schedules of fees and set charging for certain legal services are gone, and there is a huge range in what people charge. At some point, you might have to justify your bill, and if you're charging X amount for X service, you might be in breach of the ethical requirements. It might not be fair and reasonable.
I think related to that also is, you know, if you're overcharging and under-delivering, then that's sort of the worst combination of things. And part of it is also about communicating, as Manny said, a realistic, a proper estimate. And if that estimate changes, regularly updating the client about the scope of work that is required, the change in estimate that has arisen, and sending bills regularly in a long matter so that a client knows what's happening from the financial side of things.
Yeah, so a case study that comes out of the annual reports, a $15,000 fee estimate was given to a client who engaged the services of the lawyer in a criminal matter. They received a costs agreement that said that it was going to be $15,000. 3 months prior to the hearing date, the complainant received a bill just short of $15,000, $14,000. The lawyer then provided an updated cost estimates of a further $15,000 in anticipated costs up to and including attendance at the hearing. The complainant was struggling financially. They could not afford the increase in legal costs, instructed the lawyer to cease acting and requested his file be released to him. However, the lawyer refused to release the file on the basis that he was claiming a lien to secure his outstanding legal fees. So a pretty common scenario, refusing to release the file until you're paid, which is fair enough. There was then informal resolution with the assistance from the Legal Services Commissioner. An agreement was reached and an agreement was ultimately given to waive any fees above 10 grand. So
the lawyer then...
Which they'd already paid.
Yeah, which they'd already paid.
Yeah.
Was there any outcome for the solicitor, any professional misconduct complaints made against...
I think it was resolved on the basis that clearly his conduct had, he or she's conduct had not been satisfactory, but I'm not sure if ultimately there was a finding. Do you guys know that?
So I think it was just basically mediated, and so there wasn't any professional misconduct or unsatisfactory professional conduct finding.
The uniform law distinguishes between, I think the language is commercial complaints and consumer matters and disciplinary matters. So an argument about fees comes in under consumer matters, and there's all these procedures about cutting deals and having negotiations and so on. Yeah. And so unless there's something that tips it into the disciplinary, the unprofessional or the misconduct, then that's just like something like this would ordinarily just be a consumer matter. But I mean, it's a pretty raw deal for the solicitor who, I mean, they screwed up their estimate, sure, but you know, they didn't get the 14 grand that they'd done the work for. But I guess you're faced with the prospect of having to spend 3 days of your life, 5 days of your life dealing with the Legal Services Commission instead of just copping a 4 grand hit.
Yeah, but I would read into that that the original fee estimate was excessive.
But how would you benchmark that?
Well, not the original fee estimate, but the initial bill for 15 grand or 14 grand for the work done up until that point. I would read into that that was excessive, right? Because it's been settled on the basis of 10 grand only.
Could for people listening at home and maybe people in the room, how would up-and-coming solicitors counter that? Do you look at fee estimates from other firms and similar work and try and judge accordingly? Or what's a road that you can travel that sort of helps you avoid, charge it at a rate that's remunerable to you and the work that you're engaging in, fair to the client as well?
Yeah, look, I mean, it's a market system with a kind of limit, which is the fair and reasonable formula. So I think people are going to speak to colleagues, people are going to have a sense of what the market bears, and people are going to set fees accordingly.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Without breaching the ACCC Act.
Yeah, but if you charge too much, ultimately it can be unethical. So another common form of ethical breach, according to these reports, is inappropriate use of social media and either revealing privileged information or breaching maybe a fiduciary obligation to clients, which of course includes an obligation to always act in their interests and not allow conflict between your interests and their interests, certainly. So a case study coming out of the reports is this. A lawyer had represented a client in a criminal law matter which related to a family law proceeding, so a criminal charge come out of a family law proceeding, their client was a male being prosecuted, and the female witness against him was his former partner. The day after the criminal hearing, the lawyer published a number of posts on a social media website in a discussion with his friends or contacts, where he used inappropriate language in describing the former partner. So basically talked about the witness in the proceedings in a derogatory way. The complainant was made aware of these posts by a third party who saw them on the lawyer's public social media feed. The complainant said that she felt bullied, intimidated, and was concerned it would happen again should the lawyer represent that client in a future matter involving her. And there was another matter coming up for hearing. Upon being notified of the complaint, the lawyer was immediately apologetic, said he thought the post would be limited to his friends or followers and not available in a public way, and certainly was not intended to be read by the complainant. He submitted he did not intend to intimidate her or prejudice her in future proceedings, and the consequence was the lawyer completed various courses in ethics and digital media, has promised that his conduct will not be repeated, and proposed to withdraw from representing that client in the upcoming matter. On this basis, the commissioner made a finding of unsatisfactory professional conduct, and the lawyer ultimately received a caution. So this is pretty common, I think, and it's a kind of aspect of business that people are going to post things on social media about their work and perhaps highlight their wins and so forth. But you need to bear in mind, I think, a range of things, including your fiduciary obligations to your clients, your obligations to future court processes in terms of not prejudicing them. And this comes up generally, I guess, in media as well, and your relationships with the media and journalists, what you tell them, what you don't tell them. Another reality about times is groups on social media where various professionals are sharing information, and people no doubt know about the Bondi Club and other forms of groups. I think a pretty common breach, this doesn't come out of these annual reports, but a pretty common breach might be you put up information on a Facebook group about an upcoming matter. You provide enough information about that matter, even if you don't name it, that a lot of people reading it could identify the matter, and you might put a scenario up, what should I do in this scenario? And you might reveal, for example, what your defence is going to be in that matter. You might find that the police prosecutor is a member of the group, you might find that people screenshot it, and you might find that you've just told your opponent everything about your defence and what's going to happen in the matter, and that was privileged. That's then used against your client to their detriment, because your opponent can then prepare the matter on that basis, and that has definitely happened. I have seen social media posts like that. So I think privilege is another issue that comes up with social media.
Definitely. These groups, Defence Lawyers New South Wales, the Bondi Club, there are quite a few others as well, and no doubt people have groups that they might be a part of that have a smaller cohort of people in them from an organisation or whatever. They're really, really valuable tools in the profession. They're really, really useful and provide a space for really collegiate interactions with fellow colleagues. But you need to be really careful about what you're disclosing on these groups, and really carefully thinking about whether in describing some scenario for the purpose of getting your colleagues' input or advice, you might actually be disclosing confidential information, privileged information, or in a worst case scenario, telling shadowing what your defence is going to be, which then can be undermined by the prosecutor seeing it or becoming aware of it.
We don't let prosecutors into defence lawyers.
I know.
But it doesn't matter, because, you know, you shouldn't be putting these things up there anyway.
No, that's right.
So we put up some posts, or someone did it for us, asking for questions or scenarios in advance of this. And I think this scenario came up in one of those, or maybe in a different context. I could have that wrong. But someone has posed the question about is it appropriate or a good idea to use ChatGPT or some other form of AI to produce draft submissions. And it sort of caused us to think about any ethical issues about that. And this was sort of in my mind as well, because I'm sitting on a committee at the moment about AI, and there's an issue about the use of copyright material, not in what's spat out by the AI or the ChatGPT, but what goes into it. Because these apps, if that is what you call them, they draw up this huge source of information, and then they use that sometimes in an indirect way to answer the questions. So you might ask a question, what is the most popular fruit in the world? It might spit out an answer that it's apples, but to get that answer, it's drawing on a database of information. So for example, I mean, I might pose this scenario for you guys to respond to. If you were to put into ChatGPT a whole lot of information and reports about your client maybe, so a psychiatric report, previous submissions about them, and then ask the AI bot to produce a draft submission, then you're putting, I suppose, that client's information out there into the database, and I would assume not knowing anything in particular about how it might be used in the future. So would that be ethical in terms of privileged information?
I think not.
Certainly not in relation to privileged information. I mean, you have to look at the terms of ChatGPT or whatever AI you're using, but most of those terms say they can use your data that you input in any way they want. And if you've got someone who's even mildly famous or well-known or has a public profile, and you tell ChatGPT all about that person's mental health, then the next time someone types in their name and says, tell me about this person, it may well say, in 2007 they were diagnosed with PTSD.
Yeah.
Mm.
You don't know. I mean, it probably won't, but it's possible, yeah. And that's...
But I don't think it's just about potentially famous clients.
Not to be anyone.
Yeah. And I think this also comes back to thinking about what is the expected standard of legal practitioners. So not necessarily some specific rule, but if you just take a step back, you're a sort of reasonable bystander in the community, would you expect your lawyer to be sharing private information, even if it is ultimately tendered in court or has already been tendered in court proceedings, which have a public aspect to them, would you really think that's acceptable for your lawyer to be putting information about you or the client into this database of information that is then just at large somehow available to anyone in the world who uses ChatGPT or these other AI? I don't think so.
No, you wouldn't. And I think this is why it's important to think about ethics in the context of the fiduciary relationship between you and your client, because the ethical rules won't speak to every scenario, but the fiduciary obligation will. And that, in essence, is an obligation to never have a conflict between your interest and their interest, and to always put or to treat their interest as paramount. And that will govern, I think, a scenario where it might be easy and quick to use an AI type app to do something, but you need to think about the client's interests as well as the specific questions of privilege and so forth. So another common ethical failing, this doesn't come out, I don't think, of the annual reports, but comes out of speaking to some eminent colleagues, revealing privileged information without permission. Now, there's obvious examples of that, but I think there's other examples that aren't so clear. So for example, you're appearing for a client in a serious criminal proceeding, you have various conversations with the prosecutor and maybe with the court, which might lead to one of those statement of the case things that you file in indictable proceedings, or maybe not, but you've defined the issue, say in a drug case, as no question about possession, but a question about some other aspect of the case. You're ultimately sacked or withdraw, and you've actually fixed the client to a particular defence without asking them, without getting their permission to waive privilege, and they come back at you and say, well, I never actually consented to that information being released. So, so you've been going about your job trying to put the client's interests in a proper way, but you actually didn't do the fundamental thing, which is think about privilege, and you've revealed your instructions in a way that was actually a breach of privilege. And I think that's an example of trying to do the right thing, but ultimately not doing the right thing.
So, like, drugs are not an issue, Your Honour, the kind of standard thing that's said
to
the local court in a drug matter where the magistrate's wondering whether there's going to need to be a certificate.
Yeah.
You need specific instructions to disclose that, do you?
I think you could probably deal with it by way of a broad instruction that at some point I'm going to have to tell the prosecutor in the court particular things about your defence or something like that. But the client's got to be on notice, I think, if you're going to reveal that information, it's an inherent part of the process that they're consenting to.
Do I, as counsel who've got the right to make decisions for my client that necessarily a solicitor doesn't, can I waive their privilege in the moment without discussing it with them?
I think it depends. So let's say you're negotiating with the prosecutor and you have had discussions with your client that they wish you to negotiate on their behalf.
Yeah.
There might be a scenario where the extent of your instructions, either expressly or impliedly, give you permission to, for example, tell the prosecutor, look, we could resolve this by way of a plea to this charge if you drop that charge.
Yeah.
But if you don't have those instructions, then I don't think you can just bowl into a conversation with the prosecutor and, you know, based on your assessment of the case, that it looks like that'd be a good offer, just say, oh, yeah, he'll plead to this. What do you think?
Well, it's interesting because, like, and one of the things that really annoys me is that, so barristers have counsel-to-counsel communication privilege, which is to say what I say to another barrister in private should not be appearing in correspondence or in court, right? And I think there's been an undermining of that proposition, you know, particularly as you've got these people who are just coming up from solicitors in the DPP and becoming Crowns, where that's been undermined a fair bit. But the flip side to it is when it works, and if you remind them that, you know, this is under that rule and so we're having that conversation, I'm not sure there is an impediment to me having a conversation with my opponent that goes, mate, we can just sort this out this way, can't we? Right?
I mean, I think it becomes a complicated question about agency because you do have a broad power as a representative, even in some cases, to resolve matters without instructions if necessary, if that's truly in the best interest of the client.
Yeah.
So I think it's a complicated question about privilege, but it becomes a competence issue.
Yeah.
Because ultimately, if what you have done in revealing that information and limiting their options is actually not in their best interest, in fact, was incompetent, then it's an ethical issue in that sense, I think, without it being strictly a privilege issue.
It's not uncommon for me to pick up a brief, you know, that where sort of later on in the process, post-committal or something, where somebody has conceded an issue, an element or something, and I'm like, why did you do that? You know, they haven't got that point or something like that. And that's, I guess, conceding elements in particular is something that you've got to be careful about, and making factual concessions. You know, my client says that he did this or he says this at a bail application before you've got any idea of what the matter's about. It's dangerous stuff.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, especially in bail applications. So another common ethical issue that it was suggested to us is a particular problem is acting as a mouthpiece of your client, and that's unethical, but it's a massive question of degree, and it can be a common breach, and I think raises this question of the close link between competence and being ethical. Another one raised with us was this issue that's perennial, I think, of communicating with the court in the absence of the opponent. And you see that, I think, in the full range of court matters. And I've seen it even in very much in the higher court, so courts of appeal and so forth, that it's perhaps even more common. So it's not just, for example, a local court problem, but I think it is an issue in the local court, where there seems to be in the local court also a, and I think it's probably because there's not associates in the same way, so you're communicating a lot with the registry, But I've certainly seen a lot of matters where people are communicating ex parte with the registry, but they're really communicating with the court because of the nature of the communication. So I think it's a really important sort of starting point to always include your opponent on communications with the court and be aware of when it's appropriate or not appropriate to actually communicate with the court in the first place, other than obviously in open court. So I think that definitely is a common breach.
And emails.
Yeah, emails
done without permission.
That's right.
Without going to your opponent first and saying, hey, I want to send this email to the associate or to whoever, which you are required to do except for very limited circumstances. You cannot send an email to a judge's associate, and often I find that Crown does this, without the permission of your opponent.
Yeah.
When it happens, every time, pull them up on it, send an email to the associate saying that email was sent without permission. We ask that his honour disregard it in its entirety.
Yeah.
And then when you're next in open court, have your counsel or yourself pull them up on it. Because it's a big problem. There are serious forensic advantages that can be accrued by anyone by being able to send an email to a judge that explains some aspect of the case that you don't have a chance to respond to. And the next thing you know, it's listed 2 days away and your client's getting done over.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah. And it's not that you need to consent or obtain consent to what they're asking the court to do, for example. It's just about consenting to the communication. So if the Crown want to approach the associate to have the matter relisted because there's some case management issue that has arisen, it might be that you consent to the communication going, but you don't agree to what the Crown is actually proposing substantively. So, and vice versa, if you're asking for permission to communicate with the court.
Yeah, so you should seek your opponent's consent to communicate with the court in advance. It's not enough to CC them. I think that's sort of the take home on it.
Yeah.
So we thought we might talk about, which is not an issue that is not really a feature of a lot of the ethics papers that we've looked at and so forth. And it's the question of why do people act unethically? Now, I think from the discussion so far, it's pretty clear that a big part of it is just not understanding the rule completely in any particular situation. So there's that link between competence and skill and ethics. But then there's a range of other things that might cause unethical behaviour. And I'd probably outline firstly, before I hand to you guys, an unchecked and unhealthy desire to win cases. I think that's a really common cause of ethical breaches. And our profession's a competitive one. And, you know, the number of cases that you successfully appear in is going to have some influence on the future health of your business as well. So it's natural to be competitive. It's natural to want to win. But I think think we all need to remind ourselves of the discipline that we're working in a regulated environment. Ultimately, it's not about winning. It's about the rule of law and the best interests of your clients. And, you know, we see that with prosecutors who refuse to disclose exculpatory material. And we've seen these famous cases where people's whole careers are ruined because they wanted to win a case. And we've seen the cases where their whole careers are not ruined, even though they've done that. Mm-hmm. But I think a closely related thing to that is a desire to help the client. So you've got a client who you're representing and you do the wrong thing, not because you want to win in some competitive sense or not because you want your business to be better, but you want to help this person in front of you. So, you know, that could manifest in a temptation to put words in their mouth. That could manifest in a temptation to mislead your opponent because you want to help the client who can't help themselves. But again, you're working in a regulated environment. It's not about helping your client ultimately. It's about complying with the rules.
Stevie, can I just jump in there? There's a really great paper on Mark's website, Criminal CPD, by the late, great Silesh Rajan, who was a solicitor at the Aboriginal Legal Service and really tragically died very young with just a massive potential to contribute to the profession ahead of him that didn't didn't come through. But he deals a little bit in his paper, which is called Things I'm Glad Someone Told Me or Wish Someone Had When I Started, that deal with ethics. And one of them is he really implores people, do not compromise your ethics. But he says there'll be opportunities, there'll be temptations, often born out of a genuine and understandable sense of injustice at your client's plight. So you might be doing something because overall you have some broadly good intention, but he says don't. No one client, no one matter is worth your practicing certificate. Know your role, operate within the bounds given to you. And I really, there are lots of gems in that paper, so I'd really encourage anyone who hasn't already read it, or if you have, go back to it. It's got a lot of good stuff in it.
Yeah.
I mean, the temptation that some people have to kind of use clients as a cause in one way or another, either for their personal thing or even because, oh, this is a good case to change the law in the way that I want,
yeah,
as a test case, and then disregarding what your client wants to do.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's
crazy. Yeah, all that stuff has to be premised on a client who wants to do it and a client who understands it, I think. So some of the other things we've written down are drugs, gambling, ego, laziness, lack of supervision, mentoring, guidance within a practice as other causes of unethical behaviour. And I'd probably add to that mental ill health. And obviously there's increasing understanding of that, but the need to be aware of your own mental health and how that's impacting on your decisions and do things about it if you need to. We've also added money, greed, financial pressures, gambling. I think I mentioned gambling. So those are some of the things that we figure as contributing to ethical breaches. So we're pretty close to time, but I think we're going to speak now, Felicity, about how to avoid having a complaint made against you.
Yeah, there are some things that you can do, and we've talked about them in the discussion already. Obviously, knowing the rules and complying with the rules, but that's not going to necessarily avoid complaints being made against you. So there are other things that you can do in your practice to try to avoid complaints either brought to you or your employer or to one of the regulating bodies. If you think you have an ethical issue, get advice early. Get on the front foot with it. There are a range of resources available to practitioners, whether it's the Law Society Ethics Hotline, senior practitioners who just happen to be at the same courthouse with you. The public defenders will take telephone calls and answer questions, your colleagues. For barristers, any silk on one of the professional conduct committees will take calls. Seek it out. Don't just be alone with your uneasiness or your questions about whether what you're doing or what you're planning to do is ethical. And I think a key one, second one, is communicating with clients and others really effectively, managing their expectations. And this kind of points in both directions. Silas says, you're not a magician. The client needs to know this. And people have funny ideas about what it is that we do, probably from watching too much TV, etc. But there's no doubt that effective legal representation can make a big difference in a case, even a spectacular difference. But you need to communicate realistically with the client about what they can expect to happen. And he says regular doses of reality checking is essential to keeping a client happy and reducing the likelihood of a complaint. And I'd just add to that, I was chatting to one of the friends of the Whigs about this issue, and he was saying it's not just about making sure you don't give a client false promises or false hope about staying out of jail or the particular outcome or their likelihood of success in defending a matter. It's also in the other direction as well. So if you are over-egging the potential bad consequences for a client, suggesting to them or advising them that they're going to go to jail when that's just really not on the cards, that is also not appropriately managing their expectations and can lead to them not being in a position to make a good informed decision about how to instruct you, and can cause them to basically be receiving advice that is not to the expected standard, and then can have a consequence for then how they interact with the proceedings. So communicating effectively, and as we've mentioned before, being really courteous at all times, respectful, making sure that you are checking in with clients, particularly vulnerable clients, about their level of understanding, checking in with them in terms of how you can effectively communicate with them, whether it's speaking with them, whether it's using written language, whether it's using diagrams and things to explain things to them and concepts. It's really important to have that dialogue, that two-way, where you're checking in with the compliant, with the client, asking them, can you just explain back to me what you understand about that, and making sure that they... yeah, that they are actually on the same page.
So another thing to bear in mind is complaints are inevitable and unavoidable. And, you know, with that in mind, and this goes back to what Felicity said about seeking advice, even if you turn out on balance to be wrong in your decision making, whether on a competence issue or more strictly an ethics issue, if you can demonstrate that you've sought advice and that you've gone through a reasoning process, it is much more likely, perhaps even quite likely, that you're going to be cleared ultimately in terms of sanction, because you've reasoned with it, you've understood the obligation, even if maybe the call you made was on reflection not the best call, you're very likely to be fine in your interaction with the regulator.
Yeah, so file note it. If the person that you've spoken to is okay with it, send them an email saying, hey, thanks for the discussion about this.
Yeah.
Because that's pretty good evidence of that.
Yeah. So we thought we'd talk a bit about responding to complaints. So what happens when you have a complaint? And I might just kick off on that by saying something that Manny's already mentioned, which is record keeping. If you keep good file notes, if you get signed instructions when necessary, or wherever possible...
Take it seriously is the first thing I say in response to this. Like, even if it's the most rubbish complaint, if it's coming to you, if the client's coming to you, take it seriously, because you can get rid of it then.
Yeah.
If it's coming to you from a professional body, then you've really got to take it seriously, even if it's rubbish.
Mm. Yeah, and my experience in advising solicitors, which I've done a bit of on this stuff, is a very significant percentage of client-based complaints are bullshit. There's a lot of false allegations get made, and also a lot of situations where people have two different recollections of reality and the solicitor is not necessarily in the wrong. But if you don't have file notes, particularly when it's something where there would be a professional expectation that you would have recorded it, you're going to have a difficult time, like you would in any tribunal of fact, in sustaining your version, even if it's actually the truth, because you haven't done something that it would be expected that you would do, which is make a file note of it.
Mm. And I don't know what your experience is like, Manny or Steve, when you're practicing at the bar, but I'm quite surprised sometimes at the lack of note-taking by solicitors. And I think a really good rule of thumb is whenever someone is talking, you're writing down. You know, if it's on the morning tea adjournment and there's a conversation between counsel and the Crown and the solicitors involved, you're writing it down. It might seem like something that's just in the thrust of what's happening, but it can come back and be really important, and not just for protecting yourself ethically, but also substantively in the case. And I've definitely won cases, a false imprisonment case, other cases based on an excellent file note kept by a solicitor in about a conversation with a copper or whatever. So it's part of the expected standard anyway that you would be keeping notes, but it also has that insurance aspect to it in terms of potential for a complaint or responding to a complaint because you've got the file note that says, or you've got the written instructions that says X, Y, Z.
So we've only got about 2 minutes, so why don't we finish on a take-home point from each of us? So my take-home point would be really careful if you're straying outside your usual area of practice. So you're a criminal lawyer, but you take on judicial review or immigration or something like that, or a civil proceeding, much higher chance of an ethical breach. How about you, Flick? What's your take-home?
I think my take-home is to come back to this point we've come to a number of times, which is treat everyone with respect and courtesy. And you might have a really bolshy argument in court. You might say things in court about the way that the Crown has conducted its case, that it's unacceptable, it's appalling, the things that they've done, the breaches of disclosure. But when you step out, be friendly, be courteous to your opponents. It's and to your client and to their family and to everyone involved, of course, to the bench as well.
Yeah. How about you, Manny? What's your take home?
I think to try to get to the end of it, if you do find yourself faced with a complaint, either personally or from a professional body, like, actually reflect on it. In fact, even from a client, reflect on it, because even though it might be rubbish, it might not be, none of us are perfect, and you might have done something with the best of intentions, or you might have just had a bad day. And so if you reflect on it, you can often sort it out a lot quicker. And even if it's a serious thing, at the end of the day, if you plead guilty to it, as it were, you end up better off.
Yeah, and I mean, another very common breach is in responding to complaints in a less than honest way.
Mm.
So, Jim, what's your final take home?
I've got communicate, keep records, don't overcharge, stay off socials.
And the last one's impossible, but...
Ladies and gentlemen, thanks for your time this morning. I know it's early, but we really appreciate you being here. Full house, it's great to see. Thank you for participating in our podcast. Can you put your hands together for Stephen Lawrence, Felicity Graham and Emmanuel Kirkasharian, The Wigs. And thank you, Mark Dennis and the Reasonable Cause CPD.
Listening, please like The Wigs on Facebook at The Wigs Podcast. Don't forget to rate and review on iTunes.
This podcast was brought to you by Minimal Productions, produced by Jim Mintz.